This is a production of Cornell University.
SA meeting, April 21st, 2011.
Yeah. You ready in a sec?
Yes.
Okay, ready? Here. Okay, thank you. All right, now we're moving on to the next item on the agenda, which is the approval of the minutes for April 14th. These were sent out in the email, so at this time, do we have any motion? Any motion? Is there a motion to approve? It's been seconded. Call for affirmation. Second. All right, no dissent. Okay, so the April 14th, 2011 SA minutes are now approved, and at this point now I'm going to turn the SA meeting over to Representative Brockman.
Okay, thanks. Welcome everybody to the first debate over the Bill of Rights resolution, R79. Unlike usual resolutions where we, you know, come and we debate them and we ask each other, well, who did you talk to about this? I thought that it would be nice if we brought in a bunch of these academics, administrators, lawyers to come and talk to us about student rights, about this resolution, and to answer any questions that we may have about these rights. So the object of today's event is first we're going to ask the panel members questions about certain rights and about student rights in general and about this university. After we've asked the panel questions and we've exhausted the panel, we'll take a brief recess so that us student assembly members could ask those around us what they feel about this resolution, how they feel about promulgating a student bill of rights, and to try to get as much input as possible. And then we will call it back to a regular student assembly meeting, and community members will have an extra opportunity to speak at this meeting, and we will hopefully get to vote on R79. So without further ado, we'll open up the panel discussion. And I'd like to start with Professor Sawyer. And my question to you, Professor Sawyer, is how do you think What do you think of past protests and the value of rhetoric and how this relates to the Student Bill of Rights?
Right. So am I going to speak on
that? Yeah. How about I give you this?
You might tell me when 3 minutes are up. So that.
I know it's 3 to 5 minutes.
3 to 5.
But,
yeah.
Yeah, but that'll be generous.
Love. Well, to answer that question, I want to go back to a protest movement that was by far the most protracted and massive student protest movement that has occurred at Cornell, maybe ever, but certainly that occurred in my time and that I was a participant of. And I want to say, first of all, that in my view, protests are not inevitably and always directed against the administration. For example, the anti-war protests, right, of the 60s were not but directed against local administrations. But the whole point of a campus protest is usually to be able to effect change locally. And that usually means making a demand of an administration that the structure of the institution hasn't been able to accommodate well. And it's usually, of course, a matter of principle, moral demand, to put in those terms. At any rate, okay, and so this will be kind of a background talk because I don't have direct applications to the issue in hand, but maybe indirectly you'll find interesting because this demonstration, this movement was also the most protracted struggle I'm aware of over questions of free speech, actually. So and what I'm talking about is something that maybe nobody in the room except the members of the panel has ever heard of, the divestment movement. Guys, it's lost to memory, so you guys won't have heard of it, unless you were there, I will guess. Okay, the divestment movement exploded spectacularly. It seemed to us one morning there it was. That wasn't true, but it seemed like that. In this week of 1985, and the issue, of course, was the stocks Cornell held in businesses dealing in the apartheid state of South Africa. Now, the argument on behalf of the trustees and administration was that we had to stay with a policy what was euphemistically called selective divestment. Okay, selective. The argument was that total divestiture would actually harm black Africans by depriving them of jobs and protection from corporate employers that were judged to obey minimum standards of fair treatment. Right? But sounds reasonable. The African National Congress, on the other hand, was calling for a worldwide strategy of disinvestment, right, across the globe, on the argument that multinationals were supporting the regime simply by investing in it. So if total divestment occurred, if international pressure forced the collapse of a significant amount, the forced withdrawal of a single significant amount of international investment, then the apartheid regime would collapse. And that is exactly what happened, incidentally. The apartheid regime did collapse as a result of a number of factors, but that was a crucial one. And that is also the argument accepted by the students at Cornell that began the divestment protest, okay? In terms of the argument for public consumption is concerned, the argument on behalf of the protesters, which also included faculty and staff, by the way, were fact-based, broad-ranging, cogent. They were based on an ultimate moral principle. The administration tended to restrict itself to a formal argument, which is trustees are entrusted to make, and trustees make financial decisions. Financial decisions could not be based on an ethical principle. And anyway, it's up to them to do it. And it's obvious, I think, which argument would be most appealing. Well, all right, but the argument wasn't only in words. The argument was also in display, theater, spectacular display. Now, as you can all gather, the particular role that students can play in making changes in university can involve things that the rest of us can't do. We're, as you said, academics, lawyers, and administrators. We can't get out there, dress up, be in your face, get arrested in an office, get pulled out, have cameras. We can't do that, but students can, because you guys are young and footloose and all that. Okay, so So what I want to, the centerpiece then of the divestment theater, okay, which is what I want to focus on, okay, was a group of structures composed of cardboard, plywood, and wire, set up just behind Day Hall, between Day Hall and that green between Day Hall, and right out there. And it was called Shantytown. Shantytown was educational in the tent because it copied actual living conditions in the black ghettos and bantustans of South Africa. It also signified student solidarity with black South Africans, and so many students, I mean, it's obviously a weak form of solidarity to sleep whenever you choose in a shanty, but it was symbolic. And it also indicated something about the ethos of the protest movement itself, or it was intended to, you know, ideally. Something exuberantly marginal, playful, compassionate, altruistic, disinterested, an ad that repeated itself day after day for passers-by. So although the mass sit-ins and arrests at Day Hall were the main direct action, and there were about 1,200 of those in 1 week, arrests, sit-ins, Shantytown was also a form of action, right, at least as the students saw it, and they and their lawyers defined it as symbolic speech, right? So Shantytown is symbolic speech. Behind these tactics stood, for better or worse, the weight of the 60s, the tradition of the civil rights movement, the labor movement before that, Henry David Thoreau and civil disobedience, and so forth. That was good. And of course, on the other side is popular, the weight of popular revulsion against the 60s. The arguments against protests in the 60s that had been formulated and almost solidified by that time. That is to say that all protest is by definition chaotic, disrespectful, disruptive, trashy, garbage, that sort of thing. So the public display can go one way or another, can it, the effectiveness of it. Okay, when the incident, it's not irrelevant to notice that President Rhodes was charged when he became president, among other things, with maintaining order on the campus, still well known for the straight takeover, right? And obviously race was at bottom the issue, also in divestment. The Africana Center faculty, they were bitterly antagonistic to the policy of so-called selective divestment, okay? So when the semester ended and alumni weekend approached in June, it was clear that the administration couldn't have the shanty standing during the event so crucial to fundraising activities. So Day Hall labeled the Shantytown's eyesores, and they said they had to be removed because they were eyesores, and of course it was on university property, so it was the right to do it. So eyesores or symbolic speech? How far have I gone?
No, you're fine.
Oh, all right.
So, I brought pictures that you can look at your leisure if you're interested.
Oh, I can actually walk out here, right?
First of all, say Shantytown protect our freedom of speech, right? This is that they have to go. We said not, right? Custody with actual name of South Africans that died in police custody and food. put up these wooden cross right near the area of the Pentagon. And this, actually, I don't remember what this was about, the symbolic action in hell, about Pentagon is right there. I believe it was the grave.
Had to show you the symbolic speech.
Okay, what did this symbolic speech accomplish? First of all, you know, the university was used to the being sole management of news about itself. What this did was to break through that rhetoric of prudence and bash up against the moral principle. Okay, the trustees make the decisions on the financial affairs. Ethics should not be a part of financial decisions. Okay, what about Cornell's complicity in one of the most despicable regimes in the earth? Right. What about that? So the shantytowns represented right in your face the human cost of the investment strategy. You could talk dollars and cents and fiscal prudence and responsibility as long as you wanted, but then until you saw the way people actually lived as a direct result of that, then that brought South Africa to Cornell. It brought Cornell students into complicity and then into solidarity with the people that were affected on the other end of that invisible chain. That was a very powerful form of speech, I would say. Ultimately, and now I'm about done. Ultimately, there's a weapon that the administrator too that they have that ultimately wore down the protesters. The first weapon is institutional prestige. Cornell is this place that alums and donors, you know, will think of, and that would cause them to see protesters always as marginal. They may not literally be outside agitators, but they're somehow intruding, like a big mess, on this place that all of you folks once was called your alma mater, right? So this, of course, the administration always speaks for the ethos, the positive value of the institution, and hopes that works. And the other one, even more strong than that, is time, right? Because in the case of the student protest against an administration, administrators are paid. I'm one, so I can. This is true. We are paid to do a job year after year after year, and that's what we do. So if we have to work on that every day for 12 months, that's what we're paid to do, right? Students are not paid to do this. In fact, if anything, they're paid to study, right? So what the tremendous initial advantage of a protest turns quickly into a disadvantage, like within 6 weeks at most, I would say, right? In other words, the tremendous rush of enthusiasm, the excitement, look at all of us here, we're on the right side of world history and on the side of humanity, and we can make a change because look how many of us there are, and now this is what we're going to do, we're going to eat and sleep the divestment. In 6 months, all these people are still there, right? Well, I was committed at the beginning, but I got other things to do in my life. I don't agree with protests for the sake of protests, but all sorts of protests for the sake of protests is a very familiar one, okay? The high can only be sustained so long. Finally, it gets to be a pain in the butt to come to school and, you know, the third year, and there's still people out there doing their divestment protest things. So down it goes, trustees, most of two-thirds of whom actually were CEOs and financial officers professionally, they were not moved. So ultimately, you know, Cornell did not do total divestment. The apartheid regime collapsed without our help. But I just say that we have good evidence that black South Africans, including obviously Nelson Mandela, saw this shantytown and others like it on television in South Africa. And that has to mean something. All right, the university, this is my last thing, the university responded by revising, of course, this is the other third weapon, by revising the Code of Public Conduct. And they made certain changes to prevent this same situation, this deadlock from recurring. It was officially called Regulations for the Maintenance of Public Order. That sounds right, the Regulations for the Maintenance of Public Order. We call it RAMPO, RMPO, Rambo. So anyway, that was the sad upshot, but it was hardly felt like a total defeat or loss to those who took part in that. Okay, thanks.
Okay, before I go to the next speaker, does anyone have any questions or comments for Professor Sawyer and past protests? Okay, well, moving on. So, Professor Claremont, I believe you're going to enlighten us with your thoughts about the general nature of how a student bill of rights should look at a private university and so forth. So,
I want to make 3 points. The first involves the nature of rights. And the students are constantly saying Cornell can't deny me due process, Cornell can't squelch my free speech. The only entity which owes a duty or owes a duty to respect free speech or due process or whatever is the government. Cornell maintains it's not the government, that it's a private university. If they're right in that, there are no rights other than the rights that any individual has against another individual. Cornell couldn't murder you, just like no particular any individual could have murdered another individual. In other words, there are laws, non-constitutional laws that regulate relations between individuals. That would be the only source of rights, very limited. The other source, additional source, could be contract. And so essentially what you're trying to do here is create an agreement between the university and the students that bestows rights equivalent to the rights that we have against the government for free speech and due process, etc. And so that's how you want to envisage this, is the creating of an agreement that will provide the rights that don't otherwise exist. And I think that really is the justification for going forward this way, that what you're trying to do is fill the vacuum and provide those rights that I think a lot of people assume they have, but assume wrongly. So that's point one, that's sort of the nature of rights and the nature of the project. Point two would be, well, if you're going to make this agreement, where should it appear? And the logical place for it to appear really is the Campus Code of Conduct. The Campus Code of Conduct is an interesting document in that it specifies duties of students throughout their existence at the university, what you cannot do in all your activities. Its rights are mainly focused on the rights in the hearing. That a hearing is brought in. In other words, the Campus Code of Conduct isn't focused on your rights in your day-to-day life. It provides duties in your day-to-day life, but not rights. And so it does seem like a logical place to put it. Indeed, subsequent to the divestment dispute that Professor Sawyer described, there was a free speech code adopted at Cornell. It's called the Bartolo Report. It's now part of the Campus Code of Conduct. And it deals with free speech rights and symbolic speech and everything else. And so consequently, that one right is dealt with in the Campus Code already. And so in a sense, this Bill of Rights would be an extension of that idea. The third point I'd make is that, well, if you agree that the Campus Code of Conduct is proper place to put it. But actually, even if you don't agree with that, the Campus Code of Conduct deals with the conduct of students, faculty, and employees. And it deals with their duties, and it deals with their rights to free speech, and also their rights to hearing. I wonder why this is talking about a student bill of rights. As you say in your whereas, there was originally a charge to create a community bill of rights, sacred rights. Why isn't there more of a concern here with producing a community sacred of rights? Now, it's true that employees and staff you would deal with mainly by incorporating, by reference, various university policies. But, you know, the free speech rights in the current campus code are the free speech rights of employees, faculty, and staff. Why wouldn't that be your concern here? I think also it would make a much better political sell if what you come forward with is a statement of community members' rights. I mean, this is something that you can address to the university assembly, et cetera, and not a totally self-interested project, but instead dealing with the rights of the community. So those are the 3 points. One, I think this is a worthwhile project. Second, you should think about how you're going to get it adopted. I think if you come to the university and say, we want a Bill of Rights, why not come to the Campus Code Committee and say, this is what we want adopted. The Campus Code Committee adopted something to the UA, and then it's part of our agreement with the university. And then the third point is, think about, this is arguable, but think about broadly and from the Student Bill of Rights to the Community Bill of Rights.
Any questions? Okay, I'll start a speaker's list. Representative Danzer.
So on the last one, you're standing on the Student Bill of Rights, Community Bill of Rights, are there any differences you see that are necessary to differentiate between students, faculty, staff, or teachers that we can identify as students, with other things that learn by students?
Well, I did take a quick look at the special thing, and I think a lot of the stuff can be handled in broad strokes to apply to all. But things like freedom of expression, the fact is students would have a greater freedom of expression than staff, that there are restrictions on what staff can do. And so consequently, there are universities, I think you can handle that by reference to the university policy, the statistics of the policy, such and such. And then just broaden the language to include all. But, the free speech, the experience of free speech does indicate that this can be done.
Representative Kay? Part of the resolution is that the name of the resolution is that this Bill of Rights will be promulgated. So the point of that is really part of the point of the Bill of Rights, which is to educate. So it's expected, if this is to pass, that all new students will receive this as part of their orientation planning, so they'll know, hey, we have a right to participate in the student assembly if we so choose, from day one. And in terms of will this play a part in, I'm going to the judicial administrator's office and I'm trying to defend myself, I don't see us at that point yet. The point of the document, as said in the preamble, is that these will be principles to be observed. So the point is that we could all get together right now in this room and agree that a Student Bill of Rights would be nice. It would be nice to educate. It's a good document for our university to endorse. Whether or not that becomes policy will be a question that's to be answered somewhere down the road, hopefully, and that's on a much higher level than the Student Assembly. Yeah.
I think that is a good question. And the fact is, the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, there are all kinds of things to enforce that. It's not just the Penn State suit of rights, and you can revoke them and put proceedings against you. If it were part of a campus code, like the first free speeches, it in fact is enforceable at the university. And it can be used as defenses in prosecution. For example, the recent event where search and seizure, legal search and seizure was raised, and the hearing board invoked that from goodness knows where they got it. Well, it would be in the, so it could be enforced defensively that way, but you could also bring the charges against the university member who violated it. It would be a code of conduct of the university. So I think that's a great point.
And unfortunately, I'll be graduating soon, but if we could have some student assembly members working with Professor Claremont and the Codes and Judicial Committee, perhaps we could see this kind of Bill of Rights go through that process and through the University Assembly and perhaps in the Campus Code. So So I thank you for a suggestion. So moving on in the panel, I have Professor Lee Adler. We have one more question. Okay, Ray. VP Mensa. Indeed, right. Indeed, the intent is that a document like this to be observed by independent student organizations as well. Now, if you look actually at the wording of Article 9, I know I didn't want to relive the dispute with discrimination with regard to religious organizations and such. So if you'll see specifically the rights mentioned is membership in institutional-related organizations. And I think that's something that all organizations already have to abide by. So I don't see the conflict in this article. Okay. So I'll move on to Professor Adler. So, Professor Adler, if you could please tell us a little bit about the rights of students at a private university versus, say, a public university, the differences in those rights and such.
Despite it having access, because of agricultural school, the IOR school, you know, etc. This is primarily a private university. Because you're at the IOR school, that doesn't mean you're going to get constitutional rights to this state school. I've been really shocked at that. So I think we should imagine we're in a private university. And your rule is you've got no right to the private university except with the board up above, trustees, have given you. What's interesting, though, is that those rights, if they're given you, they actually have to follow. And you can get them, you know, raise and pay and develop those things from that, if they're the thing given. But that, in turn, raises the question, well, how do we get them? And that's what you're doing here. And so you should be mindful of the fact that whatever you're trying to get, if they accept it, then they're pretty much the real employee. But you've got to think strategically about that process and be aware of that tension all along the way about each principle that you're trying to get accomplished in your bill process. I think that's pretty important. Genre of rights, just to keep in mind a little bit as you all were talking about this afterwards, given that this is a private university or really a public university. That principle is something like this. I'll put this in one category: speech, assembly, petitions, protest. Some of the things that Professor Sawyer talked about today. That's one clump of rights. Second clump, and different from those in some ways, and this is something that the United States Supreme Court has spoken to. It's the whole question of fees. Exactly what can a college charge you folks for in addition to tuition? And all that kind of stuff. And also the setting up of clubs. Those are involved certain kinds of associational and other rights, which, again, in a private university are hard to locate, but if you can shake it out of them, then you can enforce it, as Professor Claremont talked about in terms of contract. Third, stuff about ethics and plagiarism, you know, those kind of things, you know, student mistakes, behavior, and consequent discipline from that. The ethical grading academic side of discipline, as opposed to stop involving wrongful places that you're drinking or smoking, you know, wild objects, that kind of thing. Those kinds of issues, when you're drafting these rights and trying to decide which ones you want to include or not include, please keep in mind those kinds of things. Try to get real concrete with each other, challenge each other about what those mean and then have other advisors have to take into account. That could be a piece of process for you all. Also, communication issues. Well, just the discipline issues separately, just separate and alone, you know, from any academic, you know, really, really major school kind of thing. And what all that means. That's where you got the most, even if you're in a private university. But not many. Not many. I'll tell you about it in New York in just a second, which has a good practice. Communication, newspapers, publications, invitations to folks. How do you build an expectancy in those conditions? And also freedoms and behaviors inside the classroom. What about these rights that you wish to have advanced? How would they be bridged, enhanced, all that, etc. Inside the classroom. What do you really want to be your right inside the classroom? And I guess one of the things that I'd like to just mention is that even though Professor Claremont is right on the button about this notion that in a private university there aren't many rights except they come from a contract that you've been able to strike. By the way, key to the contract, just so you know, is that both sides have to agree this is the deal. Not just you guys saying this is the deal. You got to get them in the mix. And then you got a contract, and then you might be able to look at this, of course. But New York has a very odd case back in 1960. pictures I've attended to that I just found this afternoon, which says even in a private university, they were going to impose, the state of New York was going to impose a case out of Madison County at Hopkins, which is a private university, a set of principles that are as broad and deep as I've ever seen in any court case involving a public university or college students from. But they were very broad, very deep, and talked about all these things about, oh, it's inherent in the old law that there's fairness in these things, there's fairness here, there's fairness there, and the way Hopkins carried itself in this disciplinary free speech thing was just wrong and proper, whatever. These words that never appear, and won't ever appear in cases about the likelihood, but every case that's looked at this has accepted it and treated it as if it's law, even though it's at a fairly low level. So, at least the existing law in New York, there's a Court of Appeals case that seems to recognize this a little bit too, which is our advisory. So, the point is that New York's pretty good on imposing a set of principal obligations on a private university to give students a fair shake around discipline and perhaps other matters as well, despite the normal conditions.
Are there any questions for Professor Adler? Representative Bajaj.
Well, whether Cornell has to, if a judge sitting in this part of the state or a federal court judge sitting in this part of the state looks at the case and says, I'm going to apply it. There's not a New York case that is inconsistent, but there's also a federal issue. Uh-huh. So, theoretically, it has some applicability.
Okay. So next up on the speaker's list is Professor Leibowitz. I believe you're going to speak about free speech and due process as rights mentioned in the Student Bill of Rights. Okay, great.
Great, thank you. Well, thanks for having this forum. I think it's really interesting, and I'm enjoying listening, so hopefully I can add something to the discussion. I thought I would try to raise some thoughts that build on what we've heard already, reinforce in some ways what we've heard, and extend a bit about kind of theoretically thinking about the issues. First, I just wanted to address the point that was made a couple times, initiated by Professor Claremont, about the notion that what you're actually looking at is creating an agreement. And I certainly don't disagree with that. I think it's correct that there's an agreement that you're probably seeking, and it would be great to have it put into the campus code if you get to that point. But I think it's also, in terms of envisioning what you're doing, I think that it can also be envisioned as a claim of rights, that you're actually making a claim about rights that you are envisioning that you would like to see adopted and respected within the university. So you are making a rights claim, but then, again, to actually make it one that is adopted and then operationalized, you may think about it as seeking an agreement and then adopt it and put into an enforcement mode within the university. And that if you think of this as a claim of rights, that consistent with thinking about an agreement, you're also looking at entering into a process of negotiation. So as Lee Adler just said, you know, you have to have two sides agreeing, but the term negotiations, I think, is very important. That is that when you are making your rights claim, when you are seeking to have it adopted, when you're seeking agreement, you are also on an equal basis with whomever you are negotiating. So if you end up negotiating with the administration, I think that the vision I have is that you are equal at that table instead of asking for rights. I think you are claiming them, but you're also negotiating to try to get an agreement about them. What I like to do when I think about issues like this is to step back and think in terms of goals. You know, why are you doing this? What are the goals that you're trying to achieve in adopting a Bill of Rights? What kind of university is it that you're seeking to create, to build, to grow? Is this a university which is open, which is encouraging of debate, which welcomes full participation by students, faculty, and staff on issues that affect them? It seems to me that those are goals that are worthy goals and that can be helpful as a vision toward which you are moving. And so I think that the discussion that we've heard about expanding this to a community statement or Bill of Rights is a good one in relation to the goals of an open participatory community, and one which in which you are seeking to build alliances with others around issues of rights and respect for rights. So with those goals in mind, I started thinking about some concepts that I oftentimes find helpful, and that is concepts of rights being defined as both negative rights as well as positive rights. So again, as a private university, you may not be able to claim that the private university must respect your constitutional rights, but in terms of thinking about analogies, notions of rights as negative and positive rights can be helpful. But in terms of thinking about distinctions from constitutional rights in the U.S., you might also think in terms of, well, we're not bound by constitutional rights. Because constitutional rights in the U.S. are oftentimes referred to and defined as negative rights, the right to be free from something, the right to be free from being silent, the right to be free from discrimination, the right to be free from having a deprivation of your property without due process of law. These are negative rights. You can't do that to me, government. And negative rights are very important, and I think that it's important to think in terms of what students, faculty, and staff should be free from in terms of the power, let's say, of the administration or the power of others who may affect those rights. But you can also think in terms of positive rights. This goes beyond what the U.S. Constitution is usually interpreted as. That is, what is it you want to claim positively as rights within the university? So, for example, a negative right of free speech is extremely important. You want to be free from censorship, certainly free from punitive action or retaliation for your speech. And these are essential negative rights. But more broadly than a negative right to free speech, if we think about this as a positive right, you could have a claim to obligations by the university to make your right of free speech meaningful. And another point I want to bring in here is seeing the interrelationship among the rights that you have listed in this draft Bill of Rights. And in particular, I want to give the example of the relationship between the right to speak and associate, protest, demonstrate, those kind of speech rights, with the right to meaningfully participate in the university about issues that affect you, about university decision-making and policy-making that affects students, staff, and faculty, that as members of this university, we can claim a positive right to participate, and that positive right to participate in those decisions that affect us can also be a claim that grows out of speech. That is, we not only have a right to speak, but a right to receive information that's relevant to being able to meaningfully participate in issues at the university. And that can cover a wide range of issues. It can be curricular issues. They can be issues about building, about investment that we've heard, issues about reorganization. And, of course, I'm thinking now about the very current debate and discussion about the Africana Studies and Research Center and the protests that have occurred, and I think rightfully have occurred, about the unilateral way in which the university has imposed this reorganization, the move of Africana from being independent to being part of arts and sciences. Now, this hasn't been done yet. And part of the claim in protest is one of procedure. We have not been consulted, which is a positive participatory right. And as part of that is the substantive claim that without being consulted, that those in Africana are not able to participate in the substance of the decision to really engage in a full discussion. And part of that is actual consultation, that right to participate, and part of that is getting full information to the full community about why the university seeks to do this. Moving on just for a couple of minutes to talk about due process. Again, as a negative right, due process is oftentimes viewed as a procedural protection. That is, I have a right to be free from, let's say, the university administration taking away my right to be a student here, unless the university gives me procedural protection through due process, notice, hearing, etc., representation, etc. And again, those are extremely important rights of due process. But again, as a positive right, I think that we can define that substantively in a way that is meaningful to us. For example, thinking about obligations on university administrators to provide support needed to give a full and meaningful exercise of rights of free speech, academic freedom, participation, etc. And again, going back to getting information as a due process claim, not just as a speech claim, seems to me to be very important. And I keep harping on this issue emphasizing this issue of information, because one of the things that bothers me a lot about the university and about the way in which I see trends going on in this university is that it seems to me more and more the university administration is clamping down on information and treating everything like a state secret, instead of the default position being everything should be open unless there's a good reason to keep it private. And I think that these rights can help to open up information so that we can all really participate as full members of the community. Thanks.
Does anyone have any questions for Professor Leibowitz? Okay. So next up. Okay, great. Question. Swastika is being drawn. Right. Mm. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I definitely understand where you're coming from. And the right to free speech in this Bill of Rights does reference part of the campus code, and the campus code does specify that while we do have this right to free speech, we don't have the right to interfere with other people's free speech. And that's how all these rights, you know, this 2 pages could have been 40 pages, because every rights have their limitations and have to be balanced with other rights. And that's my basic response to that. I do think that I enjoyed Professor Leibowitz's talk about the notion of positive rights, that if you look through this Bill of Rights, you'll see that you're not only free to do these things, you're encouraged. So dissent in a classroom is encouraged as long as you're maintaining academic standards and these sorts of things. So, you know, free speech, you don't just have a right, you should be encouraged to speak freely. And I think that was a very important point.
Can I ask something from
right.
I think that your question also raises, you know, the very difficult issue of speech
codes. And those are very, very hard kinds of discussions to have because of the concern, which is very valid, that we should all be here in a way that is welcoming and that enables us to be, again, full participating members of the campus. And what you do when there is a conflict or a potential conflict between that value and the value of speaking, which can include speech that we find despicable. Right, what do you do in that situation? And I think that there are going to be some very hard cases. But I think as a matter of principle, you know, my view has always been one which favors more speech rather than less speech. I don't want to be protected paternalistically from speech I don't like. I want to be able to bring my friends and my my comrades and my fellow travelers and such, and I want us to be able to protest, right? So it doesn't answer all the questions, right? Because there may in fact be some instances where it starts to move into something far more dangerous than a general statement that we don't want. But I do think that the basic principles are important.
Yeah, and I do think this is an excellent prelude to Professor Eric Chaffetz, who's going to talk to us about academic freedom and its limitations. So, without further ado.
Yeah, everybody hear me? Okay. First of all, let me just talk a little bit about historical context. It's pretty clear we live in a dictatorship. And I think if you read the bylaws of the university, you see that the trustees are given absolute power in those bylaws. But that's something to keep in mind as well. I get the notion of democracy sort of out of your head in that respect. We've had issues of governance here with the faculty, at least going back a long way, just since I got here with the post-resignation of President Leamy without proper consultation. And we've been trying to work out these consultation issues since then. So it's not just a problem here of students, obviously. It's also a problem of faculty governance as well. And I think that's a context that's probably good to keep in mind as well. The African Studies Center, which Professor Lieber was brought up as reports right now, on the front burner, but the education department was shut down without proper consultation as well. And so the faculty is pressed in certain ways. Now, in 1940, the American Association of University Professors issued a statement which is viable today, which is their default position on academic freedom and tenure. Traditionally, academic freedom is focused, although it does mention students in the statement, is focused on faculty and faculty rights, if you will. Again, this is not a legal document, it's a set of principles, and the AAUP, when it feels these principles have been violated, have started investigations into universities. They have censored universities, but there's no particular legal enforcement here. Fourth one, of course, has been brought up. That's an issue. It's an issue of international law as well. If you don't have enforcement mechanisms, then actually, what are you left with if you promulgate a system of law or rights? But I thought I would just read a little, it doesn't take long, from the statement, which has been modified in certain ways in 1970, to bring it up to date in certain ways. But it says the purpose of this statement is to promote public understanding in support of academic freedom and tenure. And of course, it's tied to tenure for university faculty because without the protection of tenure, academic freedom is seriously eroded. I was lead witness in a very big national case at the University of Colorado where academic freedom was systematically undermined both within the university and then in the court. And along with it, First Amendment rights were systematically undermined. The Supreme Court in 67 actually tied academic freedom, which is not identical to free speech, to free speech, and made an important component, let's say a subheading, of free speech. So it's well worth noting, this is not true at Cornell, but nationally, tenure has been eroded consistently over the last 30 years. Only 25% to 30% of all positions now in academia across the nation are tenure and tenure track positions. The rest are adjunct positions without the guarantees of tenure, and that has systematically undermined academic freedom. So what impacts on faculty also clearly impacts on students, and I want to make that particular context clear as well. So it says the purpose of this statement is to promote public understanding in support of academic freedom and tenure and agreement upon procedures to ensure that in colleges and universities, institutions of higher education are conducted for the common good and not to further the interests of either the individual teacher or the institution as a whole. I think that's important. The common good depends upon the free search for truth and its free exposition. And then it goes on in some points define specific aspects of it. It says teachers are entitled to full freedom in research and in the publication of the results, subject to the adequate performance of their other academic duties. Okay. That's the first point. Second, teachers are entitled to freedom in the classroom in discussing their subject, but they should be careful not to introduce into their teaching controversial matter which has no relation to their subject. So that is a distinct difference between freedom of speech and academic freedom. Now, there's broad, in the 1970 interpretation, they were very careful to get back to this matter of controversial. And to make it clear, and I'll just read you this, the intent of this statement is not to discourage what is controversial. Controversy is at the heart of the free academic inquiry, which the entire statement is designed to foster. This passage serves to underscore the need for teachers to avoid persistently intruding material which has no relation to the subject. But obviously there are wide parameters there, and you can imagine what they are. So it takes an awful lot, right, in the classroom to claim that somebody is not talking about the subject matter in one way or another. We could go through the subject by subject. In teaching physics, for example, you can talk about hydrofracking, for example, as it bears on what you're talking about. You can use that as an example. If you're teaching chemistry, you can talk about that as well in terms of impact. If you teach American studies, of course, and the humanities, there's a whole range of things you can bring in. If you're teaching the Vietnam War, you can talk about the Iraq War. You can talk about Afghanistan as examples of American imperialism. So there's a wide range here before something sets in that starts to be totally unrelated to your subject matter. And I think that's important to bring in. Then it talks about the fact that college and university teachers are citizens, members of a learned profession, and that outside of the university, and when not representing the university, of course, they have constitutional rights to free speech, although it enjoins members of the faculty not to act responsibly in relation to their duties as academics. Students clearly are included in these rubrics. Under the rubric of freedom to learn. So that what's being asked for in Article 6 here, right to academic freedom, students shall be free and encouraged, I'm reading from the documents you have before you, students shall be free and encouraged to express differences of opinion or to disagree with data or views offered in any course of study as long as they maintain standards of academic performance established for the course. Student performance should be evaluated solely on an academic basis, not on opinions or conduct in matters unrelated to academic standards. Selection of speakers, allocation of funds for speakers, programs, and other student activities will observe the principles of academic freedom and promote intellectual pluralism. Now, all of this is explicitly part of the principles of academic freedom outlined by the AAUP. They are more or less difficult to point to in violation. So, for example, the grading system. This is a type of all faculty should be grading on an objective basis, but students may feel, okay, I'm not being graded on that basis, I'm being graded on the basis that I disagree with the faculty member. Proof of this sort of thing seems to be is problematic at best. The question of right here, the right to academic freedom, I think is pinioned on both a certain set of objective standards, but also a certain set of subjective standards that need to be negotiated between teachers and students, and that are, I think, fraught with problems in terms of regulating them with positive or substantial rules. I know we all like to operate a system of trust in which we would hope that the faculty members doing the grading would be grading on a fair basis. And I would have to say I think in most cases that's the case. It goes on. On the other hand, I think what's really have discussions in the classroom to try to alleviate any anxiety, both on the, from the position of the professor or the student, to talk about things that they feel might be explosive. It seems to me that, that learning only goes forward when there's conflict, and I do not mean violent conflict. What I mean is reasoned conflict, when there are actual discussions about differences of opinion, rather than everybody being frightened of disagreeing or coming into conflict with either the faculty member or their fellow students. I think that's well worth stressing. Of course, one can't write a rule to make it happen in the classroom, but it seems to me that to the extent that universities are open and do encourage interaction and dialogue, real dialogue, that that can become a possibility.
Thank you, Professor Chaffetz. Unfortunately, we don't have time to ask questions because we're trying to move along so we get to debate. But you'll see in the packet there's biographical information on every member of the panel. And if you do have a question that extends beyond this meeting, I do encourage you to send them an email and try to get your answer offline. So next up is Professor Lance Compa, and my question to you is just generally your thoughts on the right to privacy and the right to private records as mentioned in the Bill of Rights.
Okay, I'm actually going to start with more specifically looking at the right to privacy clause. It's very narrowly drawn. That's a virtue in some way. It basically addresses one topic. Who can search your room? Under what circumstances? And obviously, this is an important issue of privacy. And it's, but even as simple and narrowly drawn as this is, there are all sorts of complications related to this that you probably want to think through and work through. For example, no search unless probable cause exists. What is the definition of probable cause? Are we going to be tracking the Supreme Court decisions defining probable cause? Is that a moving target? We can do that before. For example, if there's an anonymous tip that somebody is growing marijuana on the windowsill, that could be authorities, the campus authorities, campus life, or whoever it might be, there is a right to come into the room. Well, under the law, some anonymous tips are the basis of probable cause, and some aren't. It gets more complicated. What's the tradition of reliability of this particular informant? This kind of anonymous tip been worn out in the past. These are sort of complications that an attorney would that you might want to do in a little more detail. You know, we've assumed correctly that Cornell is a private university, even for the public part of it. There is an important governmental component here in Cornell, the campus police. They're deputy sheriffs. They're government. It's a hybrid. They're also employed by Cornell, but for purposes of Fourth Amendment protections and search and seizure and that sort of thing, the Constitution would apply, I think, to the campus police. And do you want to have some sort of distinction? This talks about the institution, and I take that to be the institutional residence law, and I think that whoever's running the dormitory, the residence, what are our rights vis-a-vis the administration vis-a-vis Cornell? What are our rights vis-a-vis campus police? Because then the Fourth Amendment, I think, does come into play. So the other element of this is the 24 hour rule. You've got 24 hour notice of an inspection. And it probably makes sense for something like 24 hours notice that somebody's going to come in to make a repair to the room. Coming from the local ladders and whatnot on an instant notice. But, you know, take the case, there's even, it's not an anonymous case, it's a very particularized. So and so is growing marijuana on his windowsill. You know, what's the 24 hour notice for? How does that apply? Here's so and so. In 24 hours, we're going to inspect your room to see if there's marijuana on the windowsill. Well, marijuana is not going to be there 24 hours. So if you want to make any kind of
No, great. Does anyone have questions? Well, we skipped questions, that's right. So, Dean Hubble, I understand with regard to privacy, this is a good interlude because you've had some time working with the FERPA policies and seeing the limitations on the policy, and so if you could please speak to those experiences.
Well, I want to talk about a few things here.
Okay.
Negotiate a contract for these rights. And I start by saying that in my experience, universities strive not to abridge rights, tries to abide by the constitutional rights afforded to all of us. There are exceptions, but I think that as a basic founding principle, the university has to go out of its way to abridge our rights as a community. I'd also say that I'm looking at this through a relatively non-legalistic lens. I'm looking at through, again, students' lens. I see a great opportunity here. I would like to think that you could abstract an essential set of principles that would help us something that we are constantly challenged to do. As you all know, a quarter of students every year is brand new. And a quarter of you, like Andrew here, will graduate and go off to life beyond the university. And our constant challenge is to communicate our values as a community to new students. So if you were to create an essential set of values that wouldn't be laid on the pillow of every new student in orientation, that wouldn't be a bad thing. It would be a good thing. It would help us communicate what we believe in, helps us optimize our role in your life as an education institution. So let me just say that, let me take a little step back. I want to talk about the Family Educational Rights Protection Act. Cornell, like a few of our peers, until recently, had a rule that exceeded the federal policy with regarding to FERPA and the Protection of Academic Preference, Student Academic Preference. It went like this. If you wanted to share those records with anybody, you need to sign a document permitting it. Well, about 4 years ago, we had 3 tragic student deaths on campus. And rapidly special one. And as dean of students, I was very, very worried about this. Because as I looked carefully at the events that transpired in advance of those deaths, I came to the conclusion that while hindsight is 20/20, in this case, communication with parents would have benefited the Press State lives. And without going into a lot of detail, I went, therefore, first to the associate deans of each of the colleges and started to talk about what we might do to relax our policy. We did benchmarking across the country, and we discovered that there were a few schools that had policies as strict as ours, namely MIT and Caltech. And the rest of the schools, especially the peers that we think are the most closely related to us, had other policies that permitted, at least in circumstances that warranted it, an opportunity to share academic or expert information with families. See, the irony is that FERPA was designed to protect academic records, not from families, but from a larger community. And so hence, there's a certain irony in the sense that FERPA protects records from families. It doesn't interfere, in many instances, with what are very useful communications about student academic records to families. So, on the heels of that, we had information that we should be following, namely that we should relax our policy to be more conformant with federal guidelines. That meant that we moved to a policy in which we would share academic records information with parents on the basis of an assumption that our students are dependent on their parents' income tax. So we assume that to be the case with all the students. You may choose to come to us and demonstrate that it's otherwise, in which case we will sequester your records from your parents. However, we have set it up such that where we believe it's warranted, believing we don't rush to contact parents, we don't send grades home, I don't go out of my way to talk to your parents if I don't feel it's warranted, or for that matter, the needs or the basic needs. But where we believe your health and safety is at risk, we are now permitted to share academic records information with your parents. And I think it's incredibly important, and I think it saves lives by being able to do this. Now, I can imagine as someone who tries to look at health and safety, I think it's a very important tool for us to use in moderation. Okay? Harvard sends grades home for freshmen twice a semester and following subsequent years once a year. We don't do that. Some of our other OPPs, in addition to Harvard, do that. We're not going to rush to do that. We have a very long-standing tradition to treat students as young adults. And we, of course, have this mantra about freedom with responsibility. And it continues to be a very strong part of the culture here. So we don't wish to go out of the way to bridge that. Only in the interest of your health and safety. Okay. So let me go back to the right document that you guys covered. I think that if you are to move forward successfully, you need to come up with two parts to this document. A statement of student rights and a statement of student responsibility. And they need to be abstracted, but they're essentials, so that they can be used very effectively in a way that is easily useful to our community. And if you do that, and you can do it on the foundation of the campus code that already I think has lots of the seeds that we're talking about within it, you can come up with something that can serve us mightily as we go forward, generation after generation, trying to keep in a community that is as I described in my statement here.
Okay, great. So next up is Dean of the Faculty, William Fry, and to you I ask, what do you think of this Bill of Rights in terms of the rights granted inside the classroom as the Dean of Faculty? And we've already heard discussion on academic freedom and that sort of thing, so I would just like to have your take on the subject. Correct. The right to participate.
That there's a lot of dissent that
Thank you. So last up would be the Associate Judicial Administrator, Scott Grant. And to you, I'd ask how you would view a student bill of rights in light of the campus code of conduct and the differences and in the two documents.
How's everybody doing today? I guess one first thing I want to emphasize, we're talking a lot about rights. I think it's important to note that the campus code of conduct and the judicial system in general outlines a lot of rights for students. So it outlines a lot of process. It really explains a lot of the things that have been touched on. So if you've never taken the time to read the document, I know it's like 40-some-odd pages, but do take the time to read it sometime, and I think you'll be hopefully pleasantly surprised at the number of rights in the process that is outlined in the code. And because, you know, I think a lot of times the campus code of conduct gets the impression that it's just a list of do not move list type thing. But the truth is that the list of violations can be found on page 16 to 18. It's about 3 pages of the entire campus code of conduct. The rest of the 40-plus page document discusses rights, principles, the process, appeal rights, and explains all the different participants in the system. So it really is important to recognize, as we have this discussion, that many of the things that are being discussed are in place. And in the conversations with Andrew earlier, we've noted that, and I think one of the things that we were concerned about is with the Bill of Rights to make sure that the condensed version at least points back to the long version of the rights so that there's clarity as to exactly what it says. Something that I think is also important for everybody to understand is that when a student comes before us in the campus code of conduct system, we present them with a sheet of paper that lists a general outline of the campus code of conduct process, so that they're aware that they can enter an agreement with our office, that if they disagree with us, that we can present it to the university hearing board, and that there's also appeal rights beyond the hearing board to the review board. So that students know that before they even talk to me or anyone else in my office. It also outlines all the rights that they have available to them as far as their right to remain silent, their right to consult with the Judicial Codes Council suite, provide them the contact information for the Judicial Codes Council. All the rights that are embodied in the code for an accused student, we make sure that they know that at the beginning of every conversation that we have with them. So again, I think it's really important to make sure that's clear. One of the things that often gets overlooked, and anytime people ask me about rights and about the campus code of conduct, is to also mention that the campus code also outlines the rights of complainants and victims. And I think that also it's similar to the positive rights that I had been spoken about earlier. That, you know, the rights isn't just protection for students that are involved in protests. It's not just for those students. It's also the rights of students to be free from harassment from other students, to be able to go to their classrooms without intimidation or fear. And the rights for students to be able to obtain their educations also. And so also in the campus code of conduct, there's lots of rights for complainants. And this, I think, is probably one of the areas that fewer complainants know about the rights in the campus code of conduct than I'd say few students do in the campus code of conduct. Probably one main example is that if a complainant is dissatisfied with the agreement that the judicial administrator's office is proposing, or if the judicial administrator's office doesn't pursue the case, a complainant actually has the right to make the judicial administrator show cause before the hearing board. So the judicial administrator's office can't brush the complainant's concerns under the rug, so to speak, without there being proper cause and proper explanation for that. And so these are important rights for complainants in the system, people who feel they've been wronged by another community member as well. That I think those are essential elements and essential rights that should be included in any document that's going to discuss the rights of the students. It's also, for those not familiar with the process of the creation of the Campus Code of Conduct, it really is a community document. When it was, there were proposed revisions, and it was dramatically revised a few years ago, I think it was 2008, if I'm getting my years right, there were a lot of community meetings with regards to that. There was a lot of community input from all over. And there's a very formal process to make sure that provisions to the code are appropriate, they respect the rights, they respect the process for everyone involved. Those revisions to the code would start with the Codes and Judicial Committee. It goes to the University Assembly, and then it goes to the President for approval after that. So there is a very formal process to make sure that if there are things that are not presently in the Code of Conduct with regards to rights, there is a process to amend those rights. And I encourage anyone who has questions about what that process looks like to contact a member of the Codes and Judicial Committee. Or they contact our office as well, and we'd be happy to give them the information for that process. As far as a student bill of rights that exists outside of the campus code of conduct, the Judicial Administrator's office is bound by the code. It's everything to our office, and that's how we function, it's how we exist. It outlines all the rights and procedures that we have to follow. So my only thing would be to make sure that any bill of rights that existed outside of the code was consistent so that we're not misleading students. Because I would be, I need to abide by within the campus code of conduct. There's been some talk about where a bill of rights should exist, who should extend to. A couple of points of clarification that I think would be useful for you to know is that the campus code of conduct doesn't govern academics. It doesn't govern academic integrity. It doesn't govern that whole academic field. It's really with regards to behavior and his conduct outside of that academic environment. So some of the rights that you've mentioned in the Bill of Rights wouldn't necessarily go automatically on the code as it exists now. Residence Life has housing contracts that are different than the Campus Code of Conduct. The Campus Code of Conduct doesn't extend to those housing contracts. And while the Campus Code of Conduct does in fact extend to all members of the community to include faculty and employees, it doesn't extend to faculty and employees if misconduct is alleged to have occurred within the scope of their employment. If it occurs within the scope of their employment, it goes through the employment channel and then the regular grievance procedures that they would have through that channel. So those are some key, I think, clarifications that are needed. As you just discussed, who should it extend to, where should it live, those types of things.
I'd like to thank our panel. I think we got a lot of things that we should be debating and talking about now going forward. Where should this be housed? How specific should it get with the rights to privacy? Which policy should it reference? Should we also include something that has to do with responsibilities next to rights? All these different things could now frame the debate, and I'd just like to thank you for coming, expressing your views, and helping us out as we try to have some informed discussion. So thank you. So right now we're going to take a 10-minute recess and then reconvene. It's over? What time do we got? Okay, all right. 5-minute recess and then we'll talk.
That's not helping. There's somebody, that. I hope you did have the opportunity to speak with community members about this, and that you took some good notes while the professors and administrators were talking. Unfortunately, I don't feel like we have enough time nor enough members to really get engaged in the full debate right now. So what will happen is that online, over the SA listserv, we'll start the debate up, and you can tell us what community members are saying, what you got from this, which areas you think need to be re-examined, and we'll go from there with a full debate. Do you have something, Brent?
No more.
All right. Motion. Right. Well, this will be on the agenda for next meeting, so we are here. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.